Jeremy Finley with us. His book, The Dark Above. We'll tell you how you can get the book in a moment. And, of course, we will take your phone calls as we continue talking about alien abductions and UFOs and just seeking the truth when we come back. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Jeremy Finley with us. We'll get to your calls as well. In your opinion, as we were talking about the hybridization program as well, Jeremy, you think that one is up in the air or what?
You know, I think that it's hard for me to sit there and give an opinion on something that, because I'd never want to dismiss what so many like experts in the paranormal field and what so many people have said about that's what's occurring. And you know, I'm fascinated by it. And George, you know, I'd be really interested to hear what you and your listeners think about this too, because to me, it's one of the most rampant theories out there right now that so many people are wanting to talk about. I don't know, maybe it's the whole storming of Area 51 that has everybody fired up about it, but it's something that I just have not, in all the stories that I've heard, because people tend to come up to me with stories of their abductions and things like that, and so the hybrid thing is not something I myself have heard a lot about, but I sure have read a lot about it, and you can understand why it's fascinating.
Oh, absolutely. You know, taking the religious aspects out of this for just a moment, and when you think about the vastness of the universe, how this has been formed, why we're even here, you've got to assume that there are other civilizations out there. You have to.
I mean, when you think about that, and I encourage people to just take a 5 minutes out of your day and just look and see the latest research about the expanding galaxies and how vast it is out there, and it just boggles the mind to think that we're it, right? That it would be that we would be it. And you know, I'm a man of faith. I'm a religious man, and so it's a line that I walk that is difficult as well, because you know I believe too that it's just impossible that we're the only life forms out there. So you know what this would mean to our religions and our faiths would certainly be challenged, but you just have to look at the science of it. You have to look at what's out there, and it's just too big of a space to be empty.
Absolutely. It's remarkable, though, especially as an investigative journalist. I've been a television executive for years. You've got more Emmys on me, by the way, Jeremy.
Well, you know. You earned yours, though, buddy.
And I never got my Edward R.
Oh, well,
that's a great, great honor. You should really be proud of yourself.
And I am, George. Thank you.
I mean, he was one heck of a newsman, wasn't he?
He was. God. He was. You know, I don't want to spend too much a diatribe talking about war stories, but what I love about Murrow is that he was so much of the classic challenger, right? He was the
one. And unbiased.
Oh, and unbiased. And, you know, people will ask us, and unfortunately so many young people don't know what Murrow endured and what he did to really stand up to power. And he still did that. And people didn't think, well, I mean, I'm sure he had his critics as well. But, you know, this was a man that truly scrutinized politicians and the government and was very much a truth seeker and really put it out on the line. I mean, this is a man that put it out on the line under great scrutiny. And so, you know, I tell people, hey, it's the Murrows that we're all kind of just trying to keep up the work that he did, and a legend in our industry, but also one of us. You know, he's among us. He was among those of us that are skeptics and truth seekers, and so yeah, absolutely. To be honored with one of his is one of the great ones out there. You're absolutely right.
I met Walter Cronkite once in my career.
Wow.
And you know, to those of us that have been in the industry for so long, he was like a god to us. Mm-hmm. And he's walking right past me. Right past me, and I go, Mr. Cronkite, you are something. I think I must have been about 30 years old at the time or something. And I went, God, Mr. Cronkite, it's you. And he went, yes, it is.
Why, yes, George, it is.
And on he went.
Correct. That's great. How great that you got to see him in person. That's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, he walked right past me. I mean, it wasn't one of those I was having lunch with him or anything like that.
Right.
But that was right a feat. Let's take some calls here for you. Oh, by the way, the book, The Dark Above, It's out now. Where do people get it?
Great. Dark Above is available everywhere in every bookstore. I always encourage people to go to your independent bookstores. That's the lifeblood of our industry. You know, we do love Barnes & Noble. We love, Books a Million. I just encourage people to really go for their local bookstores. It's everywhere now. The audio book will be available as well for Audible and, of course, Amazon. We have an incredible bookstore here in Nashville. It's not so small anymore. It's Parnassus Books. It's run by the legendary author Ann Patchett. And I encourage people, especially if you want a personalized copy, to go through Parnassus' website and order that, and you can get your own personalized copy that I'll be happy to make out to you.
Publisher St. Martin's Press. You've got a good one there.
Got a great one. One of the great editors, Peter Wolverton, is my editor, and stand alongside some of the great novelists of our time at that. We were in the Flatiron Building in downtown Manhattan that St. Martin has just moved out of, sadly, but it's great to have been a small part of the Flatiron history to have my book come out of there, and St. Martin is one of the great publishers, so I'm thrilled about that.
People's Magazine say X-Files fans will eat up this TV reporter's debut of this book. It's out there.
That was it was one of those really strange encounters too. I always remember my grandmother always read People Magazine, right? She had stacks of them at her house growing up. And
everybody read magazines in those days.
Oh my gosh. And I just remember our stacks and stacks of People Magazine. And so it was a very bizarre moment to open up People Magazine last, I guess it was July, and to see my mug out in there.
How
with,
cool is that?
A very kind review. So the all of the people that have embraced these novels, again, from NPR to the New York Post, just newspapers across the country and everything, it's just been really, fantastic to have people enjoy these books.
My mother, Jeremy, who's 90 years old, loved Look Magazine and Life Magazine, and I remember her bringing Look Magazine home, and this was before you got it in the mail.
Yeah.
And she said, you have to read this, Georgie. And it was about the Barney and Betty Hill abduction case.
Oh, of course.
And it was just riveting to me. I couldn't put it down.
How old do you think you were at the time when you read that? How old do you think you were?
I must have been 13 to 16, something like that, right around.
Do you think that was one of the moments of your life that you started thinking?
Oh, no question about it. Yeah, it's what helped steer me into this direction. My first interview as a radio reporter, 21 years old in Detroit, Michigan, was with Stanton Friedman, who just passed away.
Wow.
Now, what's even more stranger than anything is he was with me in Columbus, Ohio, and he died on that trip. And I was his, keep in mind, he was my first interview as a radio reporter, 21 years old. I was his last person to interview him when he died.
Isn't that something?
He had a heart attack in the Toronto airport going home.
Wow, that is, it is funny how we make these encounters with certain people that have such a prolific effect on our lives. And that's a great thing that you were able to have those encounters with him.
Are we losing with the Stanton Friedmans and the people like that? Honest to goodness, great UFO researchers. Are we replacing them? I mean, the youngest one I can think of is John Greenwald of the Black Vault. But yeah. I don't see a lot of younger people coming up doing what these other people did.
You know, the interesting thing is, and what would be really fascinating to see from a journalistic endeavor, is to see how much of the science community younger scientists are, kind of wanting to devote their lives to this. I know that, we're in this age of, when so many people will turn on the television and they'll see, reality programming or some kind of documentary programming, and those are the faces of the UFO, movement or research. And I love those shows. Don't get me wrong. I get a huge kick out of them, and I love to watch them. But the true researchers, the true people that are listening to the to the sound waves and the sounds that are emitting from space, and really trying to do the research. The people that are in the grind of it. I don't know if they're doing the work but not seeking the attention, so we don't know who they are. So I don't know, and I hope not, because we need them. We need everybody that is going to apply their scientific knowledge to trying to understand this. I think that what we're going to have, George, is we're going to have men and women from the military continue to come out and say, this is what I saw, this is what I read, this is what I experienced. And maybe that's going to be the modern age of the voice and the face of UFO research, or these people that have, come in contact with this information.
So it's 4:20 in the morning in Nashville, Tennessee right now. Are you working today at the TV station?
It's actually 3:20.
So you're on Central Time.
So I'm Central Time. I am not. I have, thankfully, interviews all throughout the day to promote the book. But I'm back at it tomorrow, and I was working last night. So how it goes with journalism, especially.
We don't stop.
Journalism. You never stop. In fact, it was 7:00 last night, and I got a call from a source, and my wife had to remind me. She's like, it's time to put the phone down.
That's
but, you always have to be available to your sources. It's just part of the job.
Absolutely. Where were you born?
So I was born in a small town in southern Illinois. I'm sorry, that's where I was actually raised. I was actually born in the central part of the state in Springfield, Illinois. But I consider southern Illinois to be my home. It's where I went. I basically grew up from 11 years old.
Well, I'm in St. Louis, so I bet I know that little town.
Well, it's right outside of Carbondale. So
yep.
It's called Carterville, Illinois.
Oh,
and
sure.
Anybody that's listening that knows that, it's a good Midwestern town there in southern Illinois that kind of straddles the South. So we both claim being Southerners and Midwesterners at the same time.
When did you leave Springfield?
We left there when I was about 11 years old, but then I came back. I went and got my master's degree at the University of Illinois at Springfield, and went and got my master's degree there, and then went back for my first job again to southern Illinois, and then from there to a couple different stops before Nashville.
You must know where Iliopolis is.
I do know Iliopolis. I do, and it's one of my favorite words to say.
I owned a horse farm out there back in the 90s, the early 90s.
Yes, Iliopolis, and it's just one of those great words that's fun to say all the time. So, yeah, it's great, and I know, I'm a huge fan of St. Louis. I love your city. In fact, I have on my St. Louis Cardinals baseball T-shirt as we're having this conversation. So one of the great the cities in the country. I'm a big St. Louis fan.
Let's go to the phones. Paul in Boston to get us started. Hi, Paul.
Hey, George. Unbelievable stories.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
I have to say one thing. The young fellow that covers you on the weekend, is that Ian or Eon?
Ian Punnett, and
Ian,
he's
fantastic program.
He's a good guy, good guy, and he was with us originally a long time ago. My first Coast to Coast show, which was April 28th of 2001, I filled in for him, and then he went off to be a college professor.
He is fantastic. You're very lucky. You're blessed. We're all blessed to have him.
Yep.
Now, before I tell you my short story, it's unbelievable that we went from zero to the moon in a short space of time with a minimum of loss of life, unfortunately. We're in the space station, again, with a minimum loss of life, and all back and forth. We had the fastest aircraft in the world, the SR-1, which could just keep going on and on and on, reheating itself. And we suddenly shelve it. Someplace down the line, they had to have been told, you can play around in your own space, but don't come into outer space, because we can't trust you to even manage Earth. And I think that's what the story is. I'll tell you what happened to me. I was coming home from work one night, and it was a dark, rainy night, and it's one of those nights where your headlights just get swallowed up on the macadam. You're lucky you can see the light behind in front of you. And suddenly, now I did military aviation when I was young, and I went up into a right echelon turn. I was up around the third story, my headlights are picking up the third stories of the industrial area around me. And I said to myself, whoa, and a few other things. And a nice, soft, feminine voice says, it's all right, don't worry about it. And I made a right-hand turn, and then I was coming back down for landing. And I had been saying a rosary at the time. And when I finished with my rosary, I kind of came out of that stupor that I was in. And I'm heading west on Route 9, up by 495. So I had to do the double route to get back down to the east side of Route 9. There's no way it can go from Route 9 east to west with a flyover. And I wound up going to the restaurant I wanted to pick up my late supper with. I was only 10 minutes out.
with no idea how you got there.
I have no idea how I got across that road.
You know, some alien abduction cases like that, Jeremy, happen where people lose time.
Of course, we hear about it all the time. When you hear talk of that, people will, as this gentleman was talking about, it happens to seem that it's in a flash, and then so much time will pass. And that's actually something that I talk about in The Dark Above to some characters that have no recollection of being taken. And it's it's a fascinating thing for us to even wrap our heads around. Is there something that is happening to where people can't remember, and this great chasm of time has passed that we don't know what's happened? And so that's, I think, one of the great mysteries of this. Is there some kind of difference when it comes to time? I we don't know, but boy, we sure do hear stories like that.
I hear rumors you're working on a cryptozoology thriller.
So that is what I'm working on next, and it is one of the most fun research I have been able to do since I started writing novels. And it's just fascinating when you talk about people's passion for UFO research and abductions and things like that. There's a great passion for that, and there is, I think, almost as equal passion for cryptozoology. And, you know, of course, it's a much smaller field of study and a much smaller, I think, field of interest, that there are animals and creatures there that we are unaware of. And it's a, I happily say that I jumped down the rabbit holes for research into these subjects. And it's just been fascinating to see, you know, what these people believe and the lengths that they're going to. And talk about scrutiny. When you talk about, you know, believing that, you know, certain animals exist or creatures exist, that's a whole new kind of scrutiny
sure
that you're going to face. So it's really fascinating work.
What do you think the Loch Ness Monster is, Jeremy?
You know, I have been fascinated with this my entire life. Like, I can't remember a day of my life where I was not. In fact, I was just on your website a couple days ago, and I was reading one of the latest stories. You know, that I think we all go back to that famous photograph, and, you know, it'll be, you know, debated.
Sticking its head and neck out. Yeah.
That's right. This is sticking the neck and its head out, and, you know, people trying to disprove that or whatever. I'm always going to go with the people that live in that area and what they have said for generations. And when you've had people for all this time talk about sightings and seeing things like this, I go back to what I was saying before. You know, they're going to be, you know, kind of the jerks of the world that try to, you know, monetize an experience like that. And that
definitely
happened with Loch Ness. But then when you go to the people that have lived there, and they'll and you will hear their stories, and it's kind of like a you know, no question that it was there.
They're great stories. Jeremy, we're going to take this break. We'll come back with final phone calls with you next on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, Whitley Strieber joins us to talk about his latest influences. And then Dr. Bruce Goldberg, the hypnotherapist, joins us as well on Coast to Coast. That'll be on our next program. And welcome back to Coast, our final segment with Jeremy Findlay as we talk about his latest novel, The Dark Above, which has got a lot of fact in there, too. Jeremy, as we were talking about the Loch Ness Monster, I think it could be a plesiosaur, one of those old-time dinosaurs.
You know, it would be fascinating. fascinating, wouldn't it, if that would ultimately be the case, that it was something from a different time, a different age that was still breeding or alive in those waters? The reading that I've done of it, and I've done a lot of reading, as I said before, that I'm a huge fan and interested in Loch Ness, is, you know, if there was something, is it still alive today? Is it still there? And I just, like, man, of all the great mysteries of my time, if there'd be someone that could just come out with proof that there was, the bones or what have you of what was in that lake, it sure would just be, it would be just one of the great stories of to be able to say, yeah, these people were right all along, and here's the proof. So, wouldn't that be amazing if something like that had somehow carried over all this time?
Let's go to Rock Hill, South Carolina. Barry's with us. Hey, Barry, good morning.
Hello there, George. And first of all, have a great weekend in Miramar. You and Tommy are going to have a ball.
Looking forward to it. Love Florida. It's a great spot.
Yeah, actually, and as a matter of fact, if you get a chance, get out to the Hard Rock Cafe at the Gamma Casino, Seminole Indians, and they've got great rock and roll on Friday and Saturday nights. But anyway, I've got a great question for you and Jeremy. And boy, Jeremy, I am enjoying this talk that you're having with the Coast to Coast audience. It is fascinating. I just grew up with Edward R. Murrow and Walter Cronkite and even Dan Rather for a while. He got kind of blackballed for a while. But anyway, a question for you guys, both of you. What do the two of you know about Area 52? All the publicity is on Area 51, but I'm starting to hear this Area 52 is real secretive. I'll take my ass off the air. Thanks, George, and good luck.
All right, Barry. Have you studied that at all, Jeremy?
You know, I've come across it in my research, and it's more of and thanks to the gentleman that was calling in, and I'm glad that you're enjoying the show as much as I am. I've come across it. It's more of a theory. I don't know, George, of much what you've heard about this, but a lot of people will talk about that it exists, that it is truly where the – I guess where it's all happened, in Area 51 is kind of a front for it. But I haven't come across a whole lot of experts coming out or people that have actually seen it or witnessed it or whatever to talk about that. So that's one that I think more exists more in a theory. But I don't know what you think, George.
I haven't heard that much about it. Where might it be? Do we even know?
You know, the thought that I have always, when I have read about it, and again, it hasn't been a whole lot, is that it's like Area 51 is a front for it, and Area 52 is actually where it's all occurred. And I don't know. I honestly don't know if they say that it's in the desert, if it's in the same location, and it's just kind of hidden. But I think it's a it's one of the really fun, you know, kind of theories out there. But I've never heard anybody talk about it in serious, you know, conversations or research.
And they don't talk that much about it at all. In wasn't there a movie about Area 52? Maybe that's what got people thinking something's going on here.
Yeah, and maybe that's where it came from. When you do so much research as I do, it all kind of blends together when it comes around. But I've definitely heard about it, and I think it's a really kind of fun, interesting theory.
It's supposed to be in Nevada, they tell us.
Yeah.
Let's go to Jan in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Jan, go ahead.
Hi.
Hi, Jan.
A really good story.
All right, let's hear it.
It's firsthand. One of my closest friends, Rosa, she actually got impregnated by an alien, and I actually felt the implant on her thigh. She had implants also, and I felt implants on two other people too.
Where's the baby?
What happened was, in the middle of the night, she could actually see, she could actually see where, like, a hand went and pulled out the baby. And then she had to go to the hospital. And they, you know, they tested her. And they said she had a miscarriage.
But there was nothing there. You think they took the baby?
Yeah, that's what she said. They took the baby because she had, regular children, so she...
Well, part of the stories of these hybridization programs, Jeremy, is that they do take the babies.
Sure, you know, that is one of the theories that are out there, and I've, you know, heard people, you know, talk about this, and of course it's been fictionalized several times and in television and movies, and, you know, I think that it's all obviously born from stories like Jan was talking about where people will talk about that, you know, this happened to them or it happened to a friend of theirs, and, you know, it's always kind of mixed with a true story of sadness, which, you know, is awful, always awful when something happens to a child, but it does come up about. And I think it's something that a lot of people, for whatever reason over history, when children have disappeared or a baby was lost, you know, I don't know how much of that is folklore or how much of that is rooted in some kind of, you know, experimentation that we're unaware of. But, you know, that's where the root of it comes from, that there are children that are taken and some kind of hybrid scenario is going on. And, you know, I've heard it. I've heard the stories, and it's always troubling.
We take text and tweet questions as well. Tom, what do you have for Jeremy?
From Karen in West Laco, Texas, I wondered if Mr. Finley can talk about John Wayne Gacy and what he thinks makes serial killers like him do what they do.
Well, that's part of your investigative work, Jeremy.
It sure is, and I'm happy to talk about it. We have a very famous serial killer that came through Nashville. His name is Bruce Mendenhall, and he would kill prostitutes as he was on the truck routes that he was on. I think, and I've spoken with a lot of my colleagues that cover serial killers, and I've attended conferences where there are experts on serial killers. And I'll tell you, to the nice lady that wrote in the question, it's fascinating work to look at the research and what's been done to put serial killers in categories. And it's really fascinating to see what these experts have determined about what causes different people to do different things. One of the commonalities I think that we've seen in a lot of serial killers is abuse of some kind themselves, whether it was physical or mental or emotional or what you will have, that occurred in a lot of these cases. And now it's awful because we have so many crimes committed by the mentally ill. And I think that if we are able to apply what we know about people that are really struggling with mental illness and apply that to some of the people that have committed these horrific crimes, there may be a connection there. There are many people that live with mental illness, you know, millions of people that live with it and thrive and do extremely well. But I think that there are a number, you know, and unfortunately we've had a number of horrific crimes here in Nashville committed by the mentally ill.
Yeah.
I think that's an untapped area of what maybe the famous serial killers of our time may have experienced as well.
Angel is with us in Louisiana. Hi, Angel. Go ahead.
Hi. I wanted to find out if you know anything about the Courtney Campbell Causeway incident. Sighting that happened in Tampa Bay on 4th of July in 1969.
That was an amazing case, which I think about 7 people experienced that kind of situation. I'm not so sure, Jeremy, if you know that specific case.
You know,
but it was a great UFO case.
Yeah, I was listening to the gentleman talk about that. It didn't ring any bells from the research that I've done, but it from what you're describing, George, it sounds like what we've heard a lot of cases about of people
missing, you know, time and everything.
Missing time, and that's something that, you know, we've run into. And what's great about that case, and just hearing about it, and I'm just trying to refresh my memory, is when there are multiple witnesses, I think that is what is always a real telling, because, you know, so many times these people are strangers. They don't know each other, and yet they're, you know, describing the same experience. So I think, you know, really, you know, gives it credibility.
John in Quincy, California is with us. Hey, John, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just wondering about the Area 51 and, you know, March on Area 51. Has anybody thought about the poor private at the front gate who, it's not an armed insurgency, so it, EMI return fire. So he has to stand there. And what does that private at the front gate do?
Well, I tell you what he does at this point, there's more than just a private at the front gate. But in this particular case, if these people start smashing the gate down and stuff, there's going to be a problem.
I think that's right, and I think the gentleman brings up a good question about the poor government worker that's out there just, you know, doing his or her job, and if this does become a bit of a circus.
He or she is not going to be alone, believe me.
That's right. They're not going to be alone, and this isn't going to – people aren't going to sneak up in the middle of the night and take anybody by surprise in this way, and that's not going to happen. If it happens, it's going to be more of a spectacle, and it'll probably be feature stories on networks and everything, and people will have a degree of fun with it. I do hope that if it is something like that, it is people just seeking the truth and not doing anything stupid, because the last thing that they want to do is get hurt or get somebody hurt in the process.
Absolutely. I mean, it's truly remarkable. With the books that you've written, the two big novels, The Dark Above, which has just come out, and of course, The Darkest Time of Night, and there's a relationship with the two books, is there not?
There is. The Dark Above is the sequel to The Darkest Time of Night. As we've talked about, the Darkest Time of Night tells the story of the abduction of a U.S. senator's grandson and what his grandmother has to do to return to her roots as a UFO researcher to try and find him, and all of the journeys that she goes through to try and find him. And then The Dark Above is the sequel. Takes place 15 years later and really begins with raising the question, what does a family do after these incredible events that they've experienced in trying to find this missing boy, but then elevates to a much greater level when the government and many of the true believers begin to realize that none of this has happened by chance and that there is a much larger and darker threat that is looming, and how all of these people from the government to this family are going to rise to try to truly understand and then ultimately fight what is coming for everyone. So The Dark Above is the sequel to The Darkest Time of Night.
Jeremy, newspapers are taking it on the chin because of the internet, but local television news seems to still be thriving.
You know, we are, and it breaks my heart about the newspaper industry, because that's what I initially was going to be. I was going to be a newspaper man. And the newspapers hold such an important role of not only of the paper of record in our communities, but also for its editorial boards and things like that. So I could talk about that forever. But television news has truly thrived, and I think here's why, is that the people reporting the news, especially the longtime anchors and reporters, are people that live in the communities. And, you know, I've lived in Nashville for 16 years. My children were born here. This is an area that I serve, and we see it as a public service. And so I think that there's a degree of that, and I think that television stations have been smart to say, okay, we're not just TV stations anymore. We are multi-platform, delivers of news and information, whether it's on your phones or your computers or your tablets, or, you know, now, of course, with, listening to streaming services. So I think we've had to adapt, and I think that's what caught newspapers, unfortunately, is that newspapers weren't able to adapt. And the information was given away free, and that was something that struggled with that. But television stations have really, I think, worked extremely hard to reach people where they are. Where they get their news is where we're reaching. And we're fully aware that we are getting your information from your phone, and we're great with that. We just know that, you know, people are going to turn to us for original weather coverage and investigations and things like that. And so I think that's why we're still very much relevant.
All right, my friend. Good luck with the work, Jeremy, and keep in touch with us, okay?
George, it's one of my favorite things to come and talk on the show, so thank you, and thank you to all the listeners who tuned in.
Those of you listening to us on WIOD News Radio 610 in Miami, in 3 hours I will be on the Manny Muniz show, so just hang with us, and you'll listen to that interview. It's going to be about our event coming up in Fort Lauderdale, so I'm really looking forward to that. So that'll be in Miami in about 3 hours. I'll be there live. So just stay awake and keep your radio tuned to 610 a.m. in Miami. For Dan Galante. Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesor, Stephanie Smith, Chris Morales, Tim Banal, and George Knapp. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.